Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics, and joining me today is Jaime Carrasco. He's been on the podcast a couple times. How are you today, Jaime?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back. It's been a while. And what a day.
What a day and what a week. We're speaking on the 13th, Friday the 13th, just after market close. It's been a very exciting week. So my first question is, if you had any indications that a crash like this was coming, let's say not necessarily the Black Swan event that was maybe the catalyst for it, but what were some of the indicators that you were looking at to see that a crash of this type was coming?
The same indicators that allow me to see the crash coming in 2008, the repo market. Just very quickly to explain to you what the repo market is, because there's a lot of misconceptions. What it really is trust between you and I, you being J.P. Morgan, me being Goldman Sachs. We can borrow money from the Fed at 4% in 2008, and we were lending to each other at about 4.25%. All of a sudden, rates jumped to 6%, meaning that there's a loss of 50% greater loss of trust between us. In October of last year, rates jumped from 2% to 10%. So not a 50% increase in loss of trust, but a 500% increase in loss of trust. That, to me, was completely logical and expected because it's signaling of how big the mess is this time around, because all we've done is kick the can down the road and try to fix a debt problem with more debt and have thrown money at this issue without really resolving anything. So that, to me, was the number one issue. And look at what happened last night. They had to throw $1 trillion now into the repo market to try to ease the liquidity of the system. Well, those are not good signals. To me, those are very bad signals, regardless of this black swan that we have right now. It's accelerating something that had already begun last year.
Have you been surprised by any of the responses of the Fed or the markets to this crisis?
Not at all. Not at all, because all they can do is throw money at the system. I keep saying the Fed and all central banks, to me, are like a monkey with an on-off switch. All they can do is turn it on, turn it off. There's no other policy response. And it's funny because throughout history, and you know, listeners would know that I'm a big history nut, especially history of money and finance, that is always the issue with the banking system. That's all they know. Lower rates, turn money on, turn the spigot off. And so we're here at this, what I think we're getting close to the end of the road, for the simple reason that, like in 1933, we have hit the maximum utility of debt. What does that mean? There's an economic fact that if you start issuing more and more debt, yes, you're going to get economic growth out of it. But the more debt you throw, the less economic growth you get. So back in 2008, we started to hit that. So today, we have trillions and trillions of dollars worth of debt, but it's not generating any economic growth. That's exactly what happened in 1933. Historically, when we get to those points of history, the only way forward is to undo the currency reserve and create a new one. And that's what gave birth to the good as gold dollar on August 5th, 1933, when Roosevelt finally pulls the plug on the old system and creates a brand new dollar to get everything going again. I think history is repeating again, and that's what the setup is to me going forward.
Absolutely. As we're speaking about the repo market, explaining to us how the bond market fits into this and why it's important in your overall thesis.
The bond market is all one. It all depends on how far out the maturities are. The traditional repo market until last October was only 14 days loans. Now what they've done, they've extend and pretend, as they always do. So now it's a longer 14 days. They're saying it's 30 days, or they keep changing the names. So you have to look at a couple of components. First of all, it's the maturity of the debt. Next, who is issuing the debt? Is it a government or a corporation or, you know, somebody with no credit rating? And then you got to look at the yield curve as one, right? And this is the problem, that people isolate those issues within the short term. Within the short term of debt, you also have to add in all of the credit derivative swaps and all of the futures contracts and all of these derivatives. Those are all based on debt. And here's the problem, that we're not counting it all. People are completely oblivious as to how much debt there is. If we look at the U.S. government's debt, all they talk about is the $20 trillion that's issued by the federal government, but that's only the line of credit. You have to look at all outstanding liabilities, and then we're talking about $250 trillion. And then the numbers go nutty from there in terms of even global debt. Look at that for a second. So go back to 2008. Yes, the stock markets have increased. You know, they've gone from $79 trillion to what? Maybe $120 trillion now, but that came at the expense. So that's an increase of about $40 trillion, but that cost us over $300 trillion in debt, right? So there is no real growth. Look at the buybacks that the companies have been going through. It's all at the expense of debt. So on a real basis, we haven't achieved anything. The problem as well is that we're not getting any growth. Go back to 2008. What was the economic growth rate that Greenspan said we needed to achieve takeoff velocity to be able to pay back all the debt that they promised that we were going to be able to pay back? It was 6.5% growth. Well, we never achieved it. The highest we ever got was 3%, and that was temporary. The average global was about 1.5%. That's what I mean by the maximum utility of debt. We have reached that point.
So when we're dealing with a crash like this, Jaime, is there a specific mechanism like a trailing stop or something like that that you use in order to keep your clients safe? Or is it more a theoretical framework that you look at things through to not rely on just a mechanism to help you get out of a trade, instead just looking at things from your broader perspective?
Okay, that's a good question. So I manage two main portfolios. One is my my special opportunities portfolio, which is a big, it's mostly composed of producers and silver and gold producers, some gold, and also a little bit of cryptocurrency or blockchain technology. That is a standalone solution for people looking to come into the gold sector because they don't have a participation. The other portfolio, though, that I manage, I call the equity income portfolio, which is more designed for my parents, that they need to generate cash flow. They need to maintain growth, capital preservation. And in that, I have about 20% in the precious metal sector. Within that portfolio, I was expecting more and more trauma to the markets to be coming, and we were ready to raise cash. 2 weeks ago, when everything started to really go haywire, we had already raised cash, by the way, in that portfolio. But 2 weeks ago, what I did is I sold 50% of the remaining pipelines, utilities, REITs, and everything else just to raise cash. But I didn't touch the precious metals companies. Many clients have been saying to me, well, why didn't we put any stop losses in the precious metals companies? Well, if you understand how I'm thinking that going forward, we're going to go into greater and greater crisis within the, that's going to require some kind of a monetary reset for which gold is within it. So my view is that the precious metal sectors is like the lifeboat of the financial Titanic, because we are facing some massive changes. So why book profits on my seat in the lifeboat at the same time that the ship, I think, is starting to go down? You know, I see it as greed is going to take over my, you know, I'm not going to be greedy versus my life, my financial life. And that's why within that, I did not take profits within the precious metals. However, in the other sectors, yes, we did raise cash, and I'm awaiting to see how I proceed going forward. Now, I'm looking at the markets right now, and we've gone through the first decline. We're definitely going to get a rally. I was listening to President Trump this afternoon, and I'm extremely surprised on, or not surprised, but I find that his response to this has been quite proper in terms of what they're doing and now the what they're setting up. So that should give us a rally going forward. However, because we're into this uncertainty for much longer, as the disease is still spreading, the virus still spreading throughout North America, there's an unknown in terms of how long before we have a true easing of the liquidity problems that we have. That means that the systemic risk is still high, and we don't know the full extent of it. Well, I can tell you that the system that we have built that is based on debt and global debt requires liquidity. People, you know, they've just canceled all payments to student debts. That's what he said. Well, in Italy, you don't have to pay your mortgage now. Well, that's affecting Deutsche Bank, right? So liquidity is the problem. And that, to me, is the catalyst for the true issue that we're facing, in that how do we continue to pump money into the system, right? Eventually, people will understand that we can't just throw a trillion overnight and it gets wasted, right? Something has to give. And in that give, the only way to do it, if you look at history, is a proper currency reserve reset. Now, currency reserve is a currency by which we trade globally. And if you listen to the messages, if you go back last October when they had the Jackson Hole banking conference, the last speech was Mark Carney, who used to be Canada's chief of the Bank of Canada. Now he's running England. Well, what did he say? He said that we all know that we have to undo the currency reserve. That is coming. But who's going to control it? Is it going to be the IMF? That's what he was really saying. Well, about a month ago, Trump was in Davos, which is head of the IMF and the Bank of International Settlements. And he said in his speech, well, the globalists are not controlling this. We're going to control it. So as far as I'm concerned, this game is afoot. This chess game is being played by the players, and it kind of shows why they're doing what they're doing to gold prices, right? Go back to when we had the big decline. Well, somebody sold $16 billion worth of nominal paper contracts. One of the problems is that the CFTC, the regulators, aren't regulating position limits. Just to put it into context, 16 billion ounces of nominal paper contracts sold in 10 minutes equates to almost 10 million ounces. Well, Russia has been buying gold like crazy. And last year, throughout all of 2019, they were only able to buy 5 million ounces. So who has 10 million ounces to sell in 10 minutes? This gold doesn't exist. What they're doing is that they're keeping the price down because they know that something is coming. On top of that, next week we have option expiry as well, by the way, so I don't think we're out of this storm just yet before the prices rebound. So there's a lot of there's a facade being presented always to the price of gold, right? Because gold is the ultimate form of money. The bankers know that. They're not selling any physical. They're buying, right? And because of that, I think in a way they're trying to keep us from the lifeboats. But I see history. I have other parameters that I'm looking at, and that's why I continue to advise that clients hold this and hold those assets, because when it's all said and done, and we're not going to know, they're not going to tell us when they're going to reset the system. At some point, they're going to have to, because there's no way forward when you look at all the debt that has been printed.
So in the short term, Jaime, before this reset comes, do you think we're headed for higher inflation?
No, we're in a stagflation. We're in a deflationary cycle now. This is the problem. This is the last thing that the banking system needs. They want inflation because with inflation they can have cash flow for the debt payments, and they can devalue the debts through inflation. However, eventually we hit the deflation, and in deflation the debts start to escalate at an unbelievable rate, and that's when the banking system loses control of the debt cycle. Through for 2,000 years of history, that's it's exactly the end of the cycle. A great book for anybody that wants to look this up is The Death of Money, which chronicles what happened in Germany through the 30s, through the Weimar Republic, right? And it's the same. It was the catalyst why Roosevelt was forced to unwind the banking system and create the brand new currency reserve. It's the deflation, not inflation, that is hitting right now.
So speaking of the banking system, Jaime, I was reading an article last night that Boeing went ahead and took out I believe it was something like $15 billion of secured credit. Do you think that this could pose a risk to crash the banking system if that serves as a catalyst for other companies to start pulling their credit lines?
Well, the problems with the banking system are many, right? If you start doing an analysis of where we have bad catalysts within the banking system, let's start with oil, right? Look at oil at $30 with everything that's happening. And by the way, part of that is the coronavirus that's slowing down the economy, but there is a massive fight going on with the Saudis and Russia, which I think they're trying to nail the fracking. Right? In essence, what's going on there is the end of OPEC. That is a massive catalyst, bad for the banking system. And by the way, it's great for the producers because that's their biggest input cost, so another positive to the gold producers that I love and I'm still holding. But for the oil companies and the American banking system that has lent billions to the frackers, that's a big problem because how are they going to pay those debts? On the banking side as well, look at what's happening in Italy, which to me, Deutsche Bank is the one that I'm looking at because that is the biggest systemic risk for the banking system itself. Well, it went below 5 euros yesterday. It went down to 4.60 before it rebounded, and I think it's trading about 5.80 right now. That is another big catalyst that could unwind the banking system because of the interconnectivity of the banking system. Now, let's talk about interconnectivity for a second because I think the one thing the coronavirus is going to teach us is the fact that we've created this global model of having everything cheap built in China instead of and then shipping it over here. Well, what happens when we have a situation where everything cuts? It's the same thing with the banking system. The banking system is fully integrated, right? Deutsche Bank goes under. They all go under. There's no ifs and buts. The credit system is one massive global mechanism that is controlled by Basel. You know, and one of the other problems, and I think Trump sees this when you listen to what he's saying, is that it's no longer controlled by even the countries. You know, who is really controlling the central banks? I think the Bank of International Settlements out of Switzerland is really the power player. How come central banks are the only ones that don't have to stick to proper accounting? Here's a simple question. Did you know that? So there was a posting this week of the gold reserves for central banks around the world. Well, that's erroneous because central banks don't have to stick to proper accounting. They've leased out a lot of their gold, but if I'm leasing something, I can't call it an asset anymore. I have to call it a liability. Central banks don't have to do that. You know, they're above us all, and that's a problem. And I think we are seeing the consequences of that problem. And now that's something that I've been ringing the bell for a long time, that historically, when we have allowed the bankers to take over the system to this extent, this is what happens. And the only solution now is to redo the monetary system completely. Luckily, we have blockchain, because I think with blockchain, we have a way to set up a decentralized system outside of their control, which is why they hate it so much. They fully understand what it is. Most people don't. And by the way, one quick thing about blockchain. Ethereum apps have crossed $1 billion now. So that system is growing. I compare it to the internet when professors were communicating with a telephone, right? It's just growing. And look at it today, the internet. Back then, the internet was used by what? 1% of 1% of people. Today, we're all interconnected. Well, that interconnectivity has allowed for this blockchain to develop. And forget Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin has too much negativity, positivity, whichever way you want to look at it, too much black and white. But concentrate on Ethereum, the fact that insurance companies, mutual fund companies, the investment companies are bringing it on board because they're saving so much money from an accounting perspective. So I think the beauty of blockchain is that it allows us to set up a decentralized banking system without the need of the banker. So I'm very optimistic as to what I see going forward.
So speaking of blockchain technologies, do you think that the recent action with the crash in the valuation of those systems, do you think that's more just a short-sightedness of the average person or – like, because if we are headed for a monetary reset, wouldn't those be great hedges to be able to get into and keep some of your currency safe?
I think it's a component of two things. The problem is the exchanges, right? The exchanges where people are parking their coins, I think eventually we're going to get everybody out of those because they're able to leverage those the same way that you can leverage gold at the COMEX, right? So I think that's the beginning of the problem is within the exchanges themselves. However, to me, that's here nor there. I've set up my positions. I'm building them, and I use asset allocation for my investment decisions. So, for example, the one company that I truly liked at the beginning, I bought as IPO, and I sat on it all for 2.5 years. Last December, I averaged down. Finally, I waited and waited to bring it up to a weighting that made sense. It went, you know, originally I had bought about a 2% position within the portfolio. It got down to less than 1%. It was so small. But then I brought it up to a 5% weighting, and I took a really nice position in it, right? So that's how I think. I don't get caught up in. I find that the best way to take the greed and fear aspect from making investment decisions is to make tight tactical asset allocation weightings, right? And that's why within the portfolio, the other portfolio that I said that we sold, the pipelines utilities, it was a tactical decision to reduce my weighting by half of whatever I had already, right? So that way I'm not getting caught up in terms of I don't want to sell this stock because, you know, I like it or I don't like it. Now, when we look at weighting, within that portfolio, we had the precious metals at 20%. They had climbed to about 30%. And now I think they're back down to 15%. So when I'm ready to start adding, I know that I'm going to be adding some of these companies that I really like, right? And the companies haven't changed.
Switching gears a little bit, Jaime, do you think that the, let's say, President Trump's response to this crisis, do you think that that is going to bode well for the Republicans come November, or is it still too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell, but I like the response that he has. And I do think that this will be the ultimate test of his for the presidency on how he does going forward. Prior to this, I did think that he would win. And I was saying that only because I kept seeing the same as I saw the 2016 election. You know, when you look at how many people are showing up to hear his speeches, how people are behaving. Like, I don't watch CNN. I don't watch the mainstream media because, to me, it's all propaganda. I have to say I've been watching it lately just because I want to stay updated as to what's happening with the virus, right? So that's more of a national emergency hurricane or something like that. But normally I stay away from the mainstream media, and I try to do my own homework using the internet, which is a much better source of information. So going forward, I think that what I'm seeing is definitely leadership within the administration. I love the news cast that they just had, where he had all of the companies that are stepping up. The fact that Walmart and Walgreens were there to set up testing facilities, even in the parking lots within the communities. I think they're moving very quickly, and that I like because they're showing leadership, right? I think what Americans want, and I think Americans like him. Americans like him because he is American, and they are the way he is, right? So, you know, what they expect more is how is he going to lead them, and he's definitely showing leadership in this. But nothing's going to be a straight line, right? The real question will be, as the virus continues spreading, what will be the true hit to the U.S.? I have to say that I'm always in the dark web, so I started listening to noise coming out of China in December. And the one thing that impressed me was that Trump actually did stop flights from China very early on, so I think that had some effect in controlling the situation. Again, we don't fully know how it's going to spread, but they have taken actions early on, and I do think that the action that they're taking now definitely seems to be setting up to give it a good fight anyways, right?
As you're speaking about, let's say, the dark web and your sources of information, do you have any trusted sources of news that you go to, or do you try and triangulate based on two or three different sources?
No, I have actually four or five websites that I'm always on. There's people I've become I really like Twitter, and there's people there that I quite enjoy, whether they're positive or negative my views. I listen to everything because I think it's important. For example, I just posted, and I try to keep my LinkedIn is where I post. No matter, you know, once in a while I come across something interesting on a website called King World News, but he always has, Rob Arnott was there, one of the money managers that I really like, right? He was there giving some pretty good advice. He's out of Asia. So I'm more interested in who is being interviewed. Greg Hunter of another guy that I follow because he always has interesting interviews. Just posted an interview with Charles Nenner, which in my opinion he's ex Goldman Sachs, but been following him from more than 20 years and one of the best psychoanalysts in the world. So he's always ahead of the curve, right? And he tends to be actually quite accurate. Now he's calling. It's a bit of a scary interview, so I don't want to dwell on it, but it's well worth knowing where we're heading, right? In order to prepare yourself. So what I would say to people is keep an eye on my LinkedIn because I'm always posting things. I like to post charts. I think it's very important to see at what's happening. The charts are showing us quite a bit of information. And I try to clean up the facts, like what did 13, 16 billion worth of nominal contracts sold in 30 minutes? Like who has that? Now another question that I would ask is, if you're the seller, don't you want to maximize your profit or do you want to just kill the price? That answers the question, right? For anybody that says, oh, you know, it was normal selling. No. If you're going to sell, you're going to be smart about selling and laying off your positions. You're not going to kill the market before the market opens, by the way, and while we're all sleeping. So, you know, I've been watching these 3 a.m. raids for many years, and, you know, I fully understand them and see them for what they are.
Excellent. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I just think coming for the next couple of months, I would be a little bit leery. I think we will get a relief rally coming in at some point here. But is it a dead cat bounce or is it going to be a good chance to unveil some of your regular positions? The one thing that I want to point out that the best deal right now, and I'm holding on to cash. I'm waiting to buy more producers. I'm watching them crash. They were already trading extremely cheap because 2 weeks ago the producers were trading as though gold was at $1,100. The HUI itself, last time gold was above $1,500, which it still is, was trading above $500. It's trading at 186 right now or 188. I can't remember where it was closing, maybe 160, which is a ridiculous price because what it's telling me is that these companies are pricing in $900 gold, which is crazy. Kirkland Lake, great example. Kirkland Lake has a buyback. They're making so much money, by the way. Kirkland Lake, Agnico, all of these guys are producing gold at our average price, I would say, about $600 Canadian. Now, $600 Canadian dollars, gold is above $2,000. So they're making quite a bit of money. Well, Kirkland Lake has been buying back its own shares. So shareholders might be selling them, but they're buying them. I think they're up to 4 million shares that they have bought back over the last month or so. But it's quite a big number. What's important, though, is that those companies are ridiculously priced. And we got to go back to 1933. The ultimate speculation was in Homestake Mining and Alaska Juno. Right. If you had $7,000 worth of gold at the beginning of 1933, by the end of the Depression, you walked away with $35,000 because the price of gold went up to $35,000. However, if you had $7,000 worth of Alaska Juno Homestake Mining, you walked away with almost $80,000 and a dividend of 15% for the period of the Depression. Why is that? Because they're producing it at 5 when they're selling it at 7. All of a sudden, they're still producing it at 5 when they're selling it at 35. And that extra cash flow went to the producers. That's why I like the producers. If history repeats, as it looks to me it is doing, well, that's going to be the ultimate safe haven. And so I do urge investors to at least hold a 10 to 20%. I have my clients at a minimum of 20% in the sector. Now, it's interesting because I am hearing from some advisors or investors that their advisors are buying them some gold corp or some company. Well, make sure it's more than 10%, because 100 shares of gold corp is not going to save you. It's going to be no different than using a toothpick as a life preserver when the Titanic sinks.
So once the price of gold starts to come back up, do you think producers are going to lead the way and then into explorers?
I would imagine. You know, it's funny. My bellwether is USA, America's silver. It's always the first one to lead, and it's always the first one to go down. So, you know, at the current level that it's at, I think, you know, it's signaling that when that one reverses, I'll definitely be keeping an eye on that one for my signal to get in. Charles Nenner, just out of curiosity, as a psychoanalyst, he did say in that at the beginning of March, that was the cycle top for gold, but it starts again in April. So he said the month of March is going to be a little bit dull for gold. It hasn't been dull. It's been painful. But because of him, I have the beginning of April as my target entry point. Also, after next week, I might be looking to buy, because it is option rollover. And as we know, at the end of every month, and especially at the end of the quarter month, where major deliveries are done, they definitely kill the price, and they have to, because there's so many short contracts out there.
You were saying that U.S. silver is your bellwether?
No, America's silver. USA is the symbol in Toronto. I always follow that one as the one that moves first, and then moves first up or down.
Is there a particular reason for that?
I think it's because it's junior, and I've just noticed that it's one of the ones that does move that way. This time around, though, I think keeping an eye on Kirkland Lake Detour, Kirkland Lake Agnico Eagle, the ones that were hit the most, will also work. But I would definitely be looking at when these things start to turn around. I would want to see gold first. I expect gold will turn first. Let's see if they manage to break it below 1,500 next week, and then we'll see. But I will definitely, I'm getting itchy to start buying. I think the prices are ridiculous right now at you know, pricing in $900 gold. Gold isn't going down to 900. My speculation is that it's going way higher, because they need to reset the system. It's the only way forward. I haven't seen one central bank sell gold. While they're not selling, I'd rather do what they're doing. And by the way, let's talk about J.P. Morgan very quickly. J.P. Morgan is within the middle of that storm. Why are they sitting on, what, almost 800 million of physical ounces of silver? Well, do as they do, not as they say. That's what I say.
Absolutely. It's easier to watch their actions and see what they're holding in their hand.
Exactly, because they know what's ahead for us.
Excellent, Jaime. We can check out your LinkedIn, correct?
Oh, anytime. It's my LinkedIn, Jaime Carrasco. I don't know. The it's easier my Twitter as well, IJ Carrasco.
Excellent.
Either one of those two are the best ways to follow what I'm seeing and how I'm presenting it to people, both through charts and interviews that I find that are well worth listening to. And by the way, I'm going to put a pitch here for Canaccord, because of all the firms, yes, we were at PDAC. We had, we have our mining team is by far doing stellar work getting ahead of this, the same way they did with the cannabis side. And they've been bringing some great, great choices to the table in terms of where to invest, and we have some awesome resources. The head of BMO join us. We have Tony Lesiak, who I've known from my Macquarie days. There's some great, great people at Canaccord on the mining side.
Excellent. Well, it's always great to have good people around you.
It is, especially when it's a cycle. It's a sector that you want to be in, and it's a cycle that I think is going to surprise people when it's all said and done as to where we're heading.
If anybody has any questions or comments about today's interview, feel free to get in touch with me at tom@palisaderadio.com. Jaime, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me back. At such a funny time.
Absolutely.
Think you understand the junior mining sector, and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people? Hit the bid.
how violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip-your-face-off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?